Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo, George Groh, and Kelly Jean Kelly. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
It has been called the first true work of science fiction and the first English horror novel. The story has been told over and over again, not just in books, but in movies and television shows.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! Oh, in the name of God.
Frankenstein, written by Mary Shelley, turned 200 years old in 2018. To celebrate, New York City's Morgan Library and Museum has a special exhibit on the writer and the book. The exhibit is set to continue through the end of January 2019. The library's John Bidwell explains why the book is still popular 2 centuries after it first appeared.
All agree that Frankenstein is a classic of world literature. But unlike many classics, it can be interpreted, adapted, abridged, parodied in so many different ways. It's infinitely adaptable. And so that's why it's had such a strong and successful career for 200 years.
One reason for the success is that Dr. Frankenstein and his creature, the monster, live on in numerous remakes, shows, comic books, and even comedies. Mary Shelley's classic is one of the most famous horror stories of all time. But Frankenstein is so much more than that. It presents ideas or themes that are still important today. Colin Bailey is director of the Morgan Library and Museum. He says the themes of Frankenstein are as important now as they were in 1818.
And it's a story that talks about science, about mortality, about morality, about kindness and compassion, as well as violence and evil. So the themes are still very present to us.
Bailey also has this advice. Read the book before seeing the movie, any of them. Shelley wrote the book when she was only 18 years old, and it relates to her own life in tragic ways.
Her mother died 10 days after she gave birth to her. She knew what it meant to be a child without a mother.
That is Elizabeth Campbell Denlinger. For the exhibit, she chose the materials that show Mary Shelley's creative process and her monster. Denlinger says it is no surprise that Shelley wrote a story about a motherless creature, one that is very much alone in the world. You could say that is a page taken from the book of Shelley's own life. Losing her mother shortly after her birth in 1797 was only part of her life story. Mary Shelley gave birth to 4 children, but only 1 child survived to adulthood. Around the age of 17, she began a love affair with the married poet Percy Shelley. The 2 writers married in 1816 after his wife killed herself. However, the marriage of Percy and Mary Shelley was short-lived. Her husband died in a sailing accident in 1822.
She was still in her 20s when she became a widow. In some ways, it's not entirely surprising that she ended up with a story about a monster without a mother. But it's one of the things that she and the creature have in common.
Critics say the fact that the monster is motherless is actually very important. Many people mistakenly call the monster Frankenstein. Hollywood movie makers have done well to mix up the two. However, literary experts say the fact that the monster remains nameless is important to the theme of Shelley's book. After the publication of Frankenstein, Mary Shelley continued to write. She died from brain cancer on February 1, 1851. Her most important legacy is a monster that is still very much alive today. I'm Ana Mateo.
Gerrymander is an old word for an idea that is still important today in the United States. The term was first used in 1812 by an artist who made pictures for a newspaper. The artist wanted to call attention to a strangely shaped voting area in the state of Massachusetts. The area looked like an animal. A salamander, to be exact. It had a strange shape because Massachusetts officials made it that way to help the political party of the state's governor, Eldridge Gerry. So the newspaper called the area a gerrymander. Over time, many people exchanged the hard G for a soft G. Today, creating a voting area for the purpose of helping a political party is commonly called gerrymandering. The issue remains in the news because politicians have a chance to recreate voting districts every 10 years after the nation's population is counted. In most states, officials from the majority party change the boundaries of voting districts after the count is completed. Each area must have about the same number of people, but officials can group similar voters together, or they can split up groups of like-minded voters to limit their power. Critics of gerrymandering argue that the way a voting district is mapped strongly influences which party wins a race, especially races for the U.S. Congress. They say the custom is not democratic. It puts the interests of political parties over those of voters. Some politicians defend the practice, especially when they are in the majority. They say gerrymandering is legal, part of the political process, or not really an important issue. They also say the Constitution gives the power to create voting areas to state lawmakers. Once again, critics object. They say the courts, including the Supreme Court, could and should step in. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Scientists are studying fossils of a large meat-eating dinosaur they describe as interesting, both in life and in death. The dinosaur is said to have lived and hunted 198 million years ago in what is now northern Italy. The fossils were discovered in 1996 close to the village of Saltrio, near Milan, in Italy's northern Lombardy area. They were found in an area where miners cut rock to use for building. This led to a long, difficult process of removing the creature's remains from the surrounding rock. The scientist reported that the dinosaur, called Saltrio Venator Zanellae, weighed at least 1 ton and was 7.5 meters long. They said this means that during the period when it lived, Saltrio Venator was the largest known meat-eating dinosaur that had ever existed. Its death also was noteworthy. After dying, Saltrio Venator somehow floated into the sea and sank to the bottom. There, the remains provided meals to numerous sea creatures before fossilizing, the researchers said. The bones show marks likely left by attacking sharks and fish. They also show signs of feeding by smaller creatures, such as sea urchins. And there are small holes in the bone, apparently left by even smaller marine worms. "This is absolutely unique," said Cristiano Dal Sasso of Milan's Natural History Museum. In scientific writings, he said, "There are reports of some dinosaur bones being attacked on land by other animals, and more rarely, insects. At least three kinds of marine animals left those traces on the bones of Saltrio Venator," he added. Dal Sasso led the researchers. Their findings were published earlier this month in the scientific journal Peer J. Saltrio Venator is the second dinosaur of its kind ever found in Italy. It combined the qualities of early meat-eating dinosaurs with those of more developed ones. The name Saltrio Venator means hunter from Saltrio. The creature walked on two legs. Each hand had four fingers, three of which possessed claws. Its head was about 80 centimeters long, while its mouth had sharp teeth. The creature was about 24 years old at the time of death, and still not fully grown. It lived in a coastal environment and likely hunted plant-eating dinosaurs and possibly smaller meat-eating dinosaurs, the researchers said. Dinosaurs are said to have first appeared on Earth about 230 million years ago, during what is known as the Triassic period. Scientists say the earliest meat-eating dinosaurs were less noticeable than larger non-dinosaur predators that died off by the end of the period. With the competition gone, meat-eating dinosaurs increased in size during Earth's Jurassic period. I'm George Grow.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. On March 4, 1829, Andrew Jackson was sworn in as president. The sky over Washington was cloudy that day, but the clouds parted and the sun shone through as Jackson began the ride to the Capitol building. Thousands of cheering supporters saw this change in weather as a good sign. So many people crowded around the Capitol that Jackson had to climb a wall and enter from the back. He walked through the building and onto the open area at the front where the ceremony would be held. The ceremony itself was simple. Jackson made a speech that few in the crowd were able to hear. Then Chief Justice John Marshall swore in the new president. In the crowd was a newspaper man from Kentucky, Amos Kendall. "It is a proud day for the people," Kendall wrote. "General Jackson is their own president." From the Capitol, Jackson rode down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. Behind him followed all those who had watched him become the nation's seventh president. The crowds followed him all the way into the White House, where food and drink had been put out for a party. Everyone tried to get in at once. Clothing was torn. Glasses and dishes were broken. Chairs and tables were damaged. Never had there been a party like this at the president's mansion. Jackson stayed for a while, but the crush of people tired him, and he was able to leave. He spent the rest of the day at his hotel room in Virginia. The guests at the White House finally left after drinks were put on the table outside the building. Many of the people left through windows, because the doorways were so crowded. Jackson was popular with many voters who saw him as representing the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his own vice president, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. Calhoun wanted to become the next president, but Jackson preferred his Secretary of State, Martin Van Buren. The split between Jackson and Calhoun deepened over another issue. Jackson learned that Calhoun had once called for Jackson's arrest. Calhoun wanted to punish Jackson for his unauthorized military campaign into Spanish Florida in 1818. The most important division between the two men was Calhoun's belief about who had more power, the states or the federal government. Calhoun came to believe the rights of the states were stronger than the rights of the federal government. His feelings became well known during a debate on a congressional bill. The year before Jackson took office, Congress passed a bill to require taxes on imports. The purpose of the taxes was to protect American industries. The state of South Carolina, Calhoun's state, opposed the measure. South Carolina, like other southern states, had almost no industry. It was an agricultural area. Import taxes would only raise the price of products the South imported. South Carolina refused to pay the tax. Calhoun wrote a long statement defending South Carolina's action. In the statement, he developed what was called the Doctrine of Nullification. The doctrine declared that the power of the federal government was not supreme. Calhoun argued that, instead, supreme power belonged to the states. He said states did not surrender this power when they approved the Constitution. In any dispute between the states and the federal government, he said, the states should decide what is right. Calhoun argued that if the federal government passed a law that any state thought was not constitutional or against its interests, that state could temporarily suspend the law. The other states of the Union, Calhoun said, would then be asked to decide the question of the law's constitutionality. If two-thirds of the states approved the law, the complaining state would have to accept it or leave the Union. If less than two-thirds of the states approved it, then the law would be rejected. None of the states would have to obey it. It would be nullified, canceled. Senators Robert Hayne of South Carolina and Daniel Webster of Massachusetts debated the question of nullification in Congress. Senator Hayne spoke first. He said that there was no greater evil than giving more power to the federal government. The major point of his speech could be put into a few words: liberty first, union afterwards. Senator Webster said Hayne had spoken foolishly. Liberty and union could not be separated, Webster said. It was liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable. No one really knew how President Andrew Jackson felt about nullification. He made no public statement during the debate. Leaders in South Carolina developed a plan to get the president's support. They decided to hold a big dinner honoring the memory of Thomas Jefferson. Jackson agreed to attend the dinner. The speeches were carefully planned. They began by praising the democratic ideas of Jefferson. Next, they discussed South Carolina's opposition to the import tax. Finally, the speeches were finished. It was time for toasts. President Jackson made the first one. He stood up, raised his glass, and looked straight at Vice President John C. Calhoun. He waited for the cheering to stop. "Our union," he said, "it must be preserved." Calhoun rose with the others to drink the toast. He had not expected Jackson's opposition to nullification. His hand shook, and he spilled some of the wine from his glass. Calhoun was called on to make the next toast. "The union," he said, "next to our liberty, most dear." He waited a moment, then continued, "May we all remember that it can only be preserved by respecting the rights of the states and by giving equally the benefits and burdens of the Union." President Jackson left a few minutes later. Most of those at the dinner left with him. The nation now knew how the president felt, and the people were with him, opposed to nullification. But the idea was not dead among some people in South Carolina. The nullifiers held a majority of seats in the state's legislature at that time. They called a special convention. Within 5 days, convention delegates approved a declaration of nullification. They said citizens of South Carolina need not pay the federal import taxes. The nullifiers also declared that if the federal government tried to use force against South Carolina, then the state would withdraw from the Union and form its own independent government.
This cut very deeply with Jackson. Jackson was a nationalist. He was a great believer in the federal union. He was a flag-waving patriot. And as Jackson saw it, nullification was the beginning of the end of the United States as a nation.
That was historian Daniel Feller. He says Jackson believed in a limited federal government. But that did not mean the people of every state should decide what the Constitution means.
That way lies chaos. As Jackson said, either we have a national government or we don't. And if Congress does pass laws which might prove to be unconstitutional, we have a procedure for dealing with that. We have the Supreme Court. We have the ability of the people and their elected representatives to appeal to Congress to repeal those laws, to take them back. But you can't have every state going off on its own and deciding what the Constitution says.
Jackson wrote a proclamation answering the nullifiers. In it, he said, America's Constitution formed a government, not just an association or group of sovereign states. South Carolina had no right to cancel a federal law or to withdraw from the Union. Jackson explained that it was his duty as president to enforce the laws of the land. Even as Daniel Feller says, if he had to use force.
It's going to come to a test of arms, and then, and this I can quote, and it was in italics, underlined, emphasized in the printed version of the proclamation. Disunion by armed force is treason. Are you really ready to incur its guilt?
Jackson sent 8 warships to the port of Charleston, South Carolina, and soldiers to federal military bases in the state. While preparing to use force, Jackson offered hope for a peaceful settlement. In a message to Congress, he spoke of reducing the federal import tax that hurt the sale of Southern cotton overseas. He said the tax could be reduced because the national debt would soon be paid. Congress passed a compromise bill to end the import tax by 1842. South Carolina's congressman accepted the compromise, and the state's legislature called another convention. This time, the delegates voted to end the Nullification Act they had approved earlier. They did not, however, give up their belief in the idea of nullification. Daniel Feller says one reason is because Southern politicians thought they might need to use nullification later. An anti-slavery movement was beginning to grow in the country. Some Southerners worried that Congress would one day make laws they did not like against slavery. The issues of slavery and states' rights would continue to be areas of conflict. Eventually, they would help start the Civil War in 1861. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.